Hi, Ellen here, jumping in right at the beginning of this week's episode to let you know that we have a special event planned for the podcast's first birthday this month. And I'm going to tell you a little more later in this episode. Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting, or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm Ellen. I am your host. And if you're new to the show, one of the things I like to kick off with, not always, but most weeks, is something that I've learned. And here's something that I learned this week. I had a listener leave a comment for me on our website. And I love this. I love hearing from you. But this comment took me by surprise. She pointed out that the phrase that I use in my intro for the podcast, "What tips do they have for you and I," is grammatically incorrect. And she's right. It should be "for you and me." And I have been listening to that intro for 12 months and this has never occurred to me. It never occurred to me that I had it wrong. And I rather pride myself on my grammar. So my first instinct when this happened was, I'll have to change that, with a bit of ensuing panic about re-recording and a bit of a sense of shame for having made such a public mistake and some hurt pride for having it pointed out to me. And that was the train of automatic thoughts that flooded my mind when I read this comment. And then I noticed that train of thoughts. I noticed my thinking and I noticed the feelings that it was creating. Feelings of anxiety and shame and fear of judgment. And I paused and I thought, hang on, what's going on here? Why am I so panicked about someone pointing out a mistake? Why do I care? Why am I so keen to hide the fact that I made a mistake? Now, I know that I care because this podcast is important to me. And I care because language is important to me. And I care because I am a bit of a perfectionist about such things. But the question I ask myself is, why should I panic about making a mistake? Why should I have all these feelings because I made a simple mistake? What's so wrong about making a mistake? Isn't making mistakes just a fact of being human? It's what we do. So I decided that I'm not going to record or re-record the intro. I'm going to leave that big old mistake right there, because it's a reminder to me that I am human and I do make mistakes. And it's okay to make mistakes because that's what humans do. And we shouldn't feel that we have to rush around patching up our mistakes or pretend that they didn't happen. We have to acknowledge them, absolutely, and we endeavour not to make the same mistake twice. But if we really want to be authentic and real and kind to ourselves, and that is something I'm really working on, then we don't deny or try to erase our mistakes. We try not to get defensive about them. We just accept that we're human and we make mistakes and we move on. So I'm moving on and looking forward to all of the other fun stuff I'm learning, and that includes today's interview, which combines a few of my favourite things: human behaviour, flourishing, work, and design. And here's a true fact. When I was in my final year of high school, I wanted to be an interior designer. I didn't. I ended up as a psychologist. But my love for well-designed spaces is still strong. And the design of workspaces that really help people to work and feel good about work is a topic I'm particularly passionate about. So I'm very excited to introduce you to today's guest. With me today and talking to us from Canada is Jacqueline Vischer, Professor Emeritus at the University of Montreal, environmental psychologist, author, consultant, and expert in how the space we work in affects the way we think,
feel, and behave. Jacqueline's consulting agency, Buildings in Use, advises companies and government agencies on planning, designing, implementing, and managing new and innovative workspaces. And she also teaches and researches on the social and behavioural impact of workspace innovation. And today I'm so excited because she's here to talk to us about our workspaces and how they might help or hinder us. Welcome, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
Oh, I can hear a little meow in the background there.
Someone wants a cuddle.
We've been joined, which is an interesting thing to talk about, you know, in terms of workspaces, having our pets at work. We might get to that. But yes. I'm interested to start by asking, what is the goal of environmental psychology? Because it's a relatively new field, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's probably most often thought of as a branch of social psychology. It was probably started, I think the first conferences were like in the 1970s or so. So it's that recent. And the purpose or the focus was really the relationship between human behavior, which is the whole range, not just our actions, but our feelings and our attitudes, our expectations, and the built environment that we occupy or environments. So the early work focused on housing a lot and on institutional design, like, well, not so much hospitals as psychiatric hospitals, prisons, courts of justice, sort of libraries, student accommodation. A lot of early studies were like that. But towards the end of about the 80s, I would say, the first studies started being done in office environments and workspace. And I guess little by little, people began to see that there was measurable relationships between how people, not just how people worked, but how they felt about their work and the kind of details of office layout, really, that they were working in. In those years, it was all pretty standardized and the whole emphasis was on sameness. Everyone should have the same desk. They should all have this. Everything should be in the same color. The lighting should all be at the same level. So the idea was that everybody was kind of doing repetitive tasks, so everybody got the same thing. But of course, then there was the big impact of office technology that started coming in late 80s, 90s. And growing. And then with that, you know, patterns of behavior and communication and the tools you needed and when you needed them and how you needed them to do your work all began to change. And so sort of starting then, I suppose, people really started to ask questions about, is this the best physical environment? And employers started saying, you know, are my people getting what they need to get their work done? And there started then to be surveys of office workers. Do you like where you're working? Are you comfortable at your desk? And certain issues began to emerge. And it's really become, I would say, since that time, a full-fledged field in its own right, you know, almost like a subspecialty of environmental psychology. And some of my Australian colleagues call it workspace psychology. I've sort of called it the environmental psychology of workspace, but I don't think there's much in it really.
Semantics. Well, it's interesting actually, because I mentioned to my husband this morning, I said, I'm interviewing for the podcast and we're going to talk about environmental psychology. And his first thought, now whether this is a particularly Australian thing, I don't know, but his first thought was thinking about more the social environmental issues, so climate change. And I think the term environmental here at least, and I don't know if that's the case elsewhere, it's very much thought of as being the broader physical environment that we live in and not so much our built environment.
Yes, and that's interesting because I would say that's also more of an emphasis in Europe, in European environmental psychology. Has also, now it's certainly happened in North America as well, and there are now people who call themselves environmental psychologists that do study the relationship to the natural environment. And I think that's perfectly legitimate. It was just that when it started, we were very specific about the built environment. Mm. And my interest has always been in what we build and then how we occupy it and then, you know, how we're affected by that. So I've always worked really my whole career with architects and designers on the built environment. But it's very legitimate to also look at the relationships with the natural environment, because that's become much more important in recent years.
It has, hasn't it? And there has been some interesting studies and research found around the impact of things like our view of water on our mental health and the nature that just the, you know, trees and green things. Biophilia hypothesis, I think they call it, don't they?
Yes, yes. Yes, biophilia. And being among trees, views of nature, things like that. Yeah, no, absolutely.
And Jacqueline, what was it? You said that this has been a kind of a growing interest for you. What was it, do you think, that really set you on this path towards what would have been a very new area of psychology, you know, a few decades gone by and still, you know, is relatively new and very exciting?
Well, it was, I think the right answer to that is that I was offered an opportunity to join a team that was studying energy consumption in office buildings. And there was a team of very technical people looking at, you know, modeling energy consumption patterns, looking at air infiltration and leakage from the envelope, looking at lighting and heat and other concerns of the interior. And there was no one on the team looking at the people in the building or how they were experiencing these conditions or how they were behaving as a function of these conditions. And so they said, well, we think we need a psychologist. Would you like to join our team? And it was, and so I did. And I must say, it was like 3 or 4 years we were together going to buildings all over Canada and measuring everything we could measure. And so I was doing surveys of office occupants. And then I had the opportunity, because we were a team of researchers, to look at data in the context of their data on acoustic conditions, on lighting, on temperature, and so on. And I just enjoyed it a lot. And I also realized there wasn't anything being done out there on this. And it was such an important part of people's lives, how the time they spend at work and the expectations of people at work. It's all such an important part of one's life, that I just saw a whole new opportunity there and I was very attracted to it.
It is exciting. And what were the findings, if you can remember, of that early work with regard to those sort of very, I suppose that they are one of the more measurable or quantifiable things, you know, the air quality and the lighting levels.
Yes. Well, I mean, looking at it as a psychologist, I thought I found some interesting things. It was still early days for screens and lighting hadn't adapted. So our number one health complaint, as it turned out, was eye strain. It's no longer the case, I might say, in this field, but at that time it was very pronounced. We looked at the relationship between temperature and indoor air quality, which was interesting because people who were having problems with air quality or who thought the air was stuffy were also complaining about being too warm. So the temperature was kind of meshed in the human experience with the quality of the air, but cold not. If they were too cold, it was definitely a temperature problem and it had to do with the ventilation and the drafts and they were sitting too close to the windows and things like that. Mm. We found a whole pattern of different kinds of reactions to acoustic conditions, which I hadn't anticipated, but we found that people's behavior as a function of noise created by coworkers was different than their behavior, and that includes their attitude and their tolerance of noise created by what you might call external sources, like coming in from outside or the mechanical systems overhead.
In what way? Were they less tolerant?
They were less tolerant of their neighbour's noise.
Yes. I did wonder whether that might be the case. So we'll put up with, you know, air conditioner noise or perhaps building noise outside or those sorts of things.
And yes.
For longer. We're more tolerant of that than we are of
Well, you see, but it's if you think about it, let's say it's the ventilation noise, it could be so loud that they could barely hear on the phone. But before they complained about that, they will complain about the fact that the neighbour in the next cubicle, because it was all cubicles then, was clipping their fingernails. But you see, that is, isn't it? It's sort of irritating, somebody clipping their fingernails at work.
So that the role of the psychologist, the role of your role within this kind of new area, was looking in large part, as I understand it, at this feeling component, these thoughts and feelings, you know, and our attitudes. I know this is not an easy question, but, you know, what are the thoughts and feelings and attitudes we have about work?
About work or about our workspace?
Well, our workspace.
Yes. Well, to answer that, I have to briefly outline what became my sort of theoretical model, which guided my research, which came out of that early work and which I built on afterwards. And it revolves around this term comfort. Because the idea, most of the measurements of things like temperature and indoor air quality standards and noise levels and everything are all predicated on a measurable definition of what the human range of human comfort is. So I use that term as well. But I felt that I had identified three areas of comfort that I could measure that were part of the human experience. And the one that was really, there's a basic one, it was really the same as what the comfort standards are measured by. So it was kind of a basic threshold without that kind of physical comfort, I think we call it. You're not even going to want to be in the building.
Yeah, if it's too hot, too cold, too noisy.
Yeah, so that became the kind of threshold. But then over and above that, there was something that I thought was very important called functional comfort. And that was the relationship between environmental conditions and the requirements of the task. So if somebody was at a screen, then a certain kind of lighting, so there wouldn't be reflections, you know, a certain kind of ability to focus, you know, without distractions. So that became part of functional comfort. If you were doing concentrated work, you didn't want to be distracted by noise. So there was a noise component of functional comfort. But if you were in a meeting or you were stopping for a coffee, you know, then you had different noise expectations and so on, you know. So it was related to the task. And we could measure that. We developed a survey instrument for measuring how functionally comfortable are you in the different settings you use for the task that you do. But then I felt I had to specify another level, which I draw it as a pyramid, and at the top is this small triangle, which is psychological comfort. And, you know, those are the feelings of kind of, I believe, are related to feelings of what you might call having a place, you know, my place, my territory, my sense of home, my sense of control over my environment, the sort of things, and then feeling that somehow, which happens in organizations, that your importance to the organization was somehow expressed through this environment. So status was an issue, you know, and if, I mean, I still know organizations that function like this, you know, the senior workers in the organization sit closest to the windows, you know, or the ones who've been there longest, something, you know, you earn your way across the floor till your desk is against a window. So there was this whole little sort of package of how of what you might call how people felt, a sort of hard to measure, but not hard to define, because everybody recognizes it. Mm-hmm. And so that became my kind of model. You know, these three definitions of comfort are related to each other, and they also are a way of explaining, if you like, the different ways in which people are affected by workspace. I believe it's specifically related to work because of the emphasis on task.
And why is this important? I mean, I'm sort of thinking a whole lot of things with reasons. And you do when you work in an office environment or you spend any time certainly observing people in office environments, you see all of those patterns of, you know, they might be complaints or people liking to decorate their spaces or resistance to moving to the office. Are there other reasons why this is important?
Why? Well, I can only talk about my experience of working in this field for so long and in so many different organizations and in different countries and in different languages. And I would say there's a most remarkable consistency. in the way that people feel about their space. And I also believe it's quite profound. You know, when I've had the experience of being walked through a building by the facilities director, and they look at him or her, they look at me, and they say, "Are you going to move my desk? You know, are you going to change something here? Am I going to lose my window view?" And it's sort of this threat, you know, my space is going to change. So we kind of anchor in emotionally somehow to the space. And it's part of our feeling of being at work and of what work means to us in this organization. It just seems to be a basic need, I think, perhaps you'd call it. So when we move, you see, I mean, I'm jumping a bit, but when we move to ABW, to the when you're working all over the building, in theory anyway, if it works properly, but the workers themselves who have to make that transition, the first issue is, where's my space? You know, where's my home? And I always say to designers and planners, you can't just supply the... It's got other names like free address or non-territorial or whatever space and expect people to embrace it. Because they from their point of view, whatever the gains are from that new space, they're losing something and they're losing that symbol of their belonging to the organization. And you have to address that. And you can do it by giving them permission to pin up personal things somewhere. You can do it by giving them a lockable drawer. I mean, it doesn't have to be a room with four walls. You know, it can be a symbol, but you have to give them that element that is theirs, I think. Anyway, that's what I always say to my clients.
And that, because in Australia, we were talking about this just before we started recording, that activity-based working, ABW, is becoming very much the new thing, the latest thing, or has been over the last few years here in Australia, this move towards. And it's not just one of the challenges I've had when I've been talking to people about this, it's been people have imagining this sort of, there's another term for it, which is the hot desking type of range.
Yes.
You turn up and you just take whatever desk is there. And then the idea of activity-based working, which is an extension of that, it's a move beyond that, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. Because the idea is that for contemporary work with all the technology that we have, I mean, a lot of it's evolved around that. And therefore, all the tools that we need for different parts of the day, for when we're doing different things, we need settings. We need a range of settings that support the work we're actually doing for that hour or for that half day or for that week. So activity-based is designing workspaces around, let's say, activities with the idea that the person performing that activity then has access to that space and is supported in how they're performing their work.
When you say supported, so you might have the technology, so you might have a meeting at 9 a.m. where you wander into the meeting room that's got the video conferencing and all of the technological setup.
Yes.
Then you move to a space where you might be doing some quiet work.
Yes, or you leave that conference with a colleague and the colleague says, you know, there's something that came up in that meeting that you and I haven't talked about yet. So then you go together and you sit in the cafe or the bistro or what, you know, whatever they've got and say, let's have a coffee and just go over this quickly. So then maybe that happened, you know, so yeah, and then the idea is you move around. But your technology has to be really very completely up to date for this to work, because if you can't move your device around and log on to your files everywhere, then the whole concept doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And that has been longer in coming than the idea of hot desking or activity-based moves. I think we're getting there now, but it's been slow.
Our optimism around technology perhaps outstripped what we're actually able to do.
And people's willingness to say, I'm happy to go to work and carry my laptop around or carry my, you know, iPad around or whatever. I mean, that's also been slow in coming. I want to go to work and sit somewhere where I can get my work done, you know, not carry stuff around. So that's a shift too.
Yeah, and it poses an interesting question, I think, and I suppose part of perhaps the undercurrent of all of these changes has been the change in the nature of work itself from those early days where we sat in one spot and created widgets or whatever we did, that kind of very industrialized, through to a work now which is in many cases knowledge-based. It happens in our heads as much as anywhere else, and our head goes wherever we go.
Yes.
Yeah, and technology, as you say, needs to allow for that.
Well, it does, but it's also made, I mean, you use the word knowledge, which is very interesting, because it means that one of the contemporary challenges in organizations is managing this knowledge, if you like, because it's not to the advantage of the organization if it stays in your head.
Yes.
So you need two things. You need, first of all, environments that help the worker acquire the knowledge that's going to be useful to them. But you also need environments that make sure that who's ever learned that shares it with the other people who need to know it and who can then themselves then use that knowledge to build up their work that they're doing or solve the problem they're solving. Okay. I think that's a very interesting way to look at workspace design, how knowledge moves through an organization and can as designers do to increase the smoothness of that.
Mm. And then the reporting of it too. I know that's been one of the interesting challenges in some of the organisations that I've worked with. It's been, so we need that transfer of knowledge, the collaboration, the way to elicit ideas, to share from one person to another, that movement, as you mentioned, of the knowledge through an organisation. But then a lot of organisations are still very keen and they need to be able to capture that as well. So where does that kind of the digital recording of all of that information so that it's there?
Well, yes, except once you're thinking in those terms, your knowledge is then static, you see. And most organizations, they realize that, in fact, the value of knowledge in part is that it not remains static. Mm. And that in sharing it, networking and passing this stuff on, new groups with new tasks and new problems will do something different with it.
Mm.
So, in fact, it's a difficult issue, that question you're raising. But I think that recording it all is going to necessarily be the route that an organization would take.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's part of that. I'm just thinking of the organizations that I have worked with for whom those issues have arisen.
Yes.
And they've been sort of large banking and finance, very compliance-driven type organizations that... I suppose, yes, perhaps you're suggesting that there might be some mental shifts that have to take place. I don't know. I mean, compliance will always be around to some extent. It's, I suppose, how that happens and whether it needs to be done. I mean, the people that I were talking to were still, they were moving from a very paper-based organisation where everything was recorded and things were printed and they were put on paper files and that was how everything had been done, and trying to shift to a more digital way of managing that. But I think the psychological processes underneath hadn't moved on yet. There was still an expectation that all we were doing really is just keeping the same...
Fixing it, yes.
Yeah, which is an interesting shift in the nature of work over time.
It is a big one. And the thing I was going to say is that I think that... it's one of the reasons why teams and teamwork and this whole emphasis on what is rather loosely called collaboration has become so important, because then you have a dynamic system based on people being in contact with each other. And it's a way to move knowledge and get it, you know, applied.
Mm.
And so a lot of the when we were talking about innovative workspace and new workspace has to do with making sure that people are in contact with the members of their team, but then teams are in contact with other teams, and that there is, you know, life and dynamism and energy in that whole process.
Yes, which is a very big shift from those images that we have of the early days of an office where people sat in their little, at their desk, very static.
Sat at their desk in rows, and then there was the era where everyone was in a cubicle.
Mm.
And then when the partitions were very high and then you didn't see people, and then there was the era where the partitions came down and you got the landscaped office with a few plants in it. Yes, it is interesting.
Yeah, and it is going to be a dynamic thing. I suppose it's always been a dynamic thing, but this is where psychology gets to play a bigger part now that there's a recognition of what we can add in helping that process, especially as the people become more and more important. Not that people were not important previously, but I guess we're understanding that it is the interaction between people and the movement of that knowledge that's happening because of the interaction between people.
Yes, yes.
That's going to make the difference.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Sort of problem-solving skills, or using knowledge to solve problems. I think of it as, I like to use this term, human capital. And I've written about that because people sort of say, oh, human capital, you mean your employees. But you mean a bit more than that. You mean what's in your employees' heads. You know, what they know about the company and what problems they solved before and what, you know, how they did it and who they did it with. And then that gets passed on and perhaps the problem's a little bit different this time, but that knowledge is there from the last time. You know, that's your human capital.
Mm.
And not just from the past, but also, you know, the skills that you brought in from your training or your previous job, which, I mean, everybody arrives with a set of skills.
Mm.
So I think that that's perhaps a better way to think about human capital, because then we can, again, we can link it to environment.
Mm.
And we say, you know, human capital needs to flourish in this organization.
Yeah, yeah, it is capital as a resource, isn't it? But yes. Even then, I know we've moved away from the terms human resources as well, because it doesn't sound, it's not good face validity, I think. People don't like the term.
No.
You got so interested in doing this work that you then went on to study architecture as well, is that right?
Well, I had actually already got my degree in architecture. I did that because when I was completing my psychology degree, I just became very interested in architecture. I just thought it was an interesting thing. And at that time, there wasn't much discussion about a back and forth between those disciplines, but I happened to be in a place and time where there was a group that was interested in this. And so this was at the university where I ended up doing my doctoral degree, because they were unique at the time in that they'd set up a program for doctoral research in the Department of Architecture and among the architects, but you didn't need to be an architect to be admitted. You could be, it was social science and architecture.
Interesting.
Psychology or sociology. So I thought, oh, that's great. You know, two of the things I really like in one program. So that's how that happened. So it's a PhD in architecture, which doesn't qualify me to stamp drawings or anything like that. But it did mean that I spent pretty much most of my career with architects and teaching architects.
Okay. And so you now, with your own consultancy firm, Buildings in Use, you work with designers and architects now in terms of trying to incorporate some of this, I suppose, human side of work and how we do it and how we feel about it?
I do. It's not usually, it happens, but it's not usually the designers that hire me or people like me. It's usually the client, I mean the architect's client.
Mm.
But I like to have a designer on the team. I don't necessarily need one, because often a lot of the work that I do with a company is what you might call, I think what you would call it is change management. It's a change management, it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
What I like about working that way is because if you link change management to workspace change, you have a very concrete set of issues that have to be resolved. And because you have to make physical design decisions, you know, about partitioning, about workspace size, about circulation, about how much people can move around, things like that, the project can't go anywhere without those decisions. And so I like to work with the users themselves and with their managers, and it draws everybody into this dialogue about what change is going to actually physically, concretely mean. And I just think it's wonderful for that. So that's useful to have the designer, because then they can draw up concepts and they can say, look, this will fit on the floor, but this won't. here's other ways of doing it. When I had, when my firm was bigger, I had my own team, a design team. But I don't get necessarily hard for that aspect of it. I really get hard to talk, first of all, to go through with them what their needs are so that we can have an idea of the goals of their project. What do you want to have achieved with this change? And that's always interesting because no one's ever quite sure. And then they have to agree with each other. So
yes, I imagine that would be quite a long and drawn out process.
It can be. Sometimes it never gets past that. But then, you know, then we can get into looking at what the, once they've set their priorities and they have an idea of what they want, then we can look into ways that that could be implemented. And what are the issues that get raised by the different kinds of, you know, you start with fairly large grain solutions, like, what, you know, how big are the teams and where are they seated relative to each other? And are they on different floors, or do we all need them all in another separate building, you know? So there are big decisions like that. But then you can keep on working all the way down to where specific teams, and this is your workspace, and this is where you're going to be on the plan now. You know, who has to sit where, and do you want an activity-based concept? Would you want your own desks? You know, I would get them engaged in that. And whenever I work like that, by the time the new workspace is then actually, it's gotten designed, they've been involved all the way through, it's gotten built and they've moved in, they're absolutely ready for all the changes. And they make full use, which is valuable from the employer's point of view, because his employees are right away making full use of these resources that the environment is offering. Whereas if they just get moved in, you know, half of what the client spent their money creating doesn't get used right away, and sometimes never.
Because people haven't made that kind of psychological and behavioural shift.
Yes, and required. They haven't prepared themselves, they haven't prepared their teams, you know, they're a bit cross about it, a little bit of resentment. And so it's actually very cost effective, I think, to do it this way for a corporate client, and government has done it for too.
Yeah, and I think this is work that really has to be done at the beginning, doesn't it? You know, all of that beginning, getting everybody on board, involved, all of that thinking and planning, even asking those questions, which I think it seems like such an obvious question. And yet I know from my own experience and, you know, from how organisations run that it probably doesn't get asked, you know, what are you trying to achieve here?
Yes, no, I know. It's just kind of like assumed. Yes.
Yeah.
No, yeah. You're right. It changes everything to make that explicit. Because then I can really say to them, okay, you've set out 8 or 10 goals here. Now let's set priorities on them. And then that's another whole thing. What's the most important? And it's, no, it's just completely essential, I think, that sort of
thing. But yes, probably not done as often as it needs to be or asked.
Sometimes companies say, why should I go through all that? Because really, we've just got old furniture and all I want is just to have, you know, get some new stuff in, maybe paint the walls and have it look a bit nicer. I don't need any change management. And then I say, that is a lost opportunity, because every time you change the environment, you have an opportunity to improve processes, what they call business processes. You can make improvements. You can get rid of problems, make things work better. Maybe find some new technologies that you aren't using. And I call it the new workspace opportunity. And sometimes they agree with me and they say, oh, okay, well, we'll work on that. And sometimes they don't.
Can only do what you can do, put the question out there.
That's it. And I think that it is an opportunity. I just think that it really is an important opportunity for all organizations when they change their space. There's something. It can be real small scale. You know, maybe you have your company might be 8 people, you know, but there's still going to be someone that says, if I sat over there next to her instead of over here by myself, I could get these problems solved more quickly. Well, you didn't know that before, so then you do it.
Yeah. So actually even just thinking through, observing the behavior of your people, thinking about the nature of their tasks, the work they do, the goals you're trying to achieve, how, where they might be positioned, or even, yeah, just that flow of information, I'm guessing, will be impacted if we can just make it even smaller.
Yes, you're right.
So what does the future of workplaces look like? What's going to happen? Do you have a crystal ball that you can kind of give us an indication of what might be coming next?
Well, I read two interesting articles recently, which I thought both carried indications of future we might be looking at least in part. One of them was about designing workspace for workers with handicaps. In this particular case, it was on the autism spectrum, mm-hmm. where there's, you know, often a lot of competence and knowledge, but you need a certain kind of environment in order for the people to feel comfortable enough to be able to function. And so it's not limited, obviously, to physical design, but there's a whole kind of how do you manage a space like that so that the people working there feel comfortable and can reach their, you know, their optimal productivity. And I thought, well, I think that's an interesting direction because people who, you know, we have this tradition in workspace design to standardize, everybody needs the same. I mean, it dates from years back, but it hasn't fully left us. Mm. And I think that indicates perhaps the beginnings of a shift out of that mentality and saying, depending on the kind of work that I need done and the kind of people that I want to hire to do it, I'm going to have to think about workspace that meets their needs.
So starting to look at sort of that.
Yes.
Individual difference and even their neurodiversity. So, you know, what the yeah. subset of our teams and workforce, what are they, you know, are they introverted? Are they extroverted? Are they...
Yes. Well, you know, I must say, yes. You might want to not get too carried away because it's actually endless. But starting at the more sort of broader cut end of the, you know, of the discussion to where, you know, you might want people. You might, you know, have opportunities, let me put it that way, to hire a workforce that are perfectly suited to doing the kind of tasks that you need done in your organization. And in order for that, I mean, I prefer to think in terms of the work requirements than the personality requirements. Mm-hmm. But think of it in terms of getting that work done, then you might make adjustments to the environment in a way that suits this particular group of people and can make them productive and, you know, contributing members of the workforce.
Yeah, that does make sense.
So that was one. And the other one was, where did I read it? There's a lot growing organization in North America, but I think it's international, called WeWork.
Yes, we have it here.
Yes, I thought you did. And I think that that's also an interesting trend. The fact that more and more people are not full-time salaried employees. You know, they work on projects, or they work on two or three projects for different clients at a time. Anyway, I think this whole shift towards more autonomy and independence of workers and shifting away from this employee of a large organization mentality, and then all the requirements of that space. So it was about, you know, they're all doing different things, but they can see other people while they're working, you know, as opposed to sitting at home and
yes.
Put the cat out and, you know, answer the phone and run and pick up the kid at daycare. I mean, there's a place to go to work, mm-hmm. but it's for people who are not necessarily working together, but who enjoy some social contact. And then there's all ramifications of that. And I thought to myself, I think this is going to be a growing new way of working.
Yeah. Interesting that you say that, because I'm speaking to you from our local co-working office where I have taken up residence.
Yes.
And I worked from home for the better part of 18 years doing that kind of juggle of all the things, and thoroughly enjoyed it in many ways, but started to feel a need for more contact for the purpose of networking, but also just for the purpose of talking to other people who might not do what I do, but are similarly, you know, either self-employed or consultants and local.
I think that the networking is one thing, the social contact is another, but I think there's another, which is that sometimes working with people with different skills, you can reach out if you need help on something and somebody has had an experience that you're experiencing for the first time, and they're there and they can say, oh yeah, well, this is what I did. Can't do that when you're working at home. You know, you're alone with the problem, whatever it is. I've worked it.
That's a good point, because we have, I'm thinking about our setup here, and what's interesting about it is some of us are consultants or freelancers, or, you know, running our own small businesses with staff or without, but others are people who might travel, they're working, so we're in Ballarat, which is about 100 kilometres from the centre of Melbourne, so they may work for a Melbourne-based organisation, they spend a couple of days there, but they live here, and so it's more convenient, it's a better match for their family and or the whole work-life piece to be able to spend some time in a local office. And so their employer is actually paying for them to use this space, which is a different way of doing it again. And technology allows that.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And well, anyway, I think you're also seeing that as a possible future trend, that large and growing numbers of workers, I think, because these new young generations enter the workforce now, I think they're much more sort of psychologically prepared for that kind of independence and adventure in a way. It's more adventurous.
Yes, I do wonder. I have two children who are 10 and 7. I wonder what work will look like for them. It could be vastly different.
It could well be, yes. When these office towers that we're building so enthusiastically in all our downtowns are going to be WeWork centres.
yeah, where people will come in, you know, on perhaps every day, but perhaps not on the occasional day. So much more travel as well as people move around to different locations.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yes, it is interesting. I think it's an interesting time to be looking at this whole field, actually. Mm. And the design reflects that. There's a lot of interesting and innovative workspace designs now that you wouldn't have seen, you know, what, 15 years ago even, they wouldn't have thought of it.
Yeah. I actually was working with a client yesterday with two big office buildings in the Docklands, which is sort of the relatively new business area in Melbourne.
Yes.
One is a big bank building that has, you know, moved, I think, to more activity-based working, but I just sat in the foyer and watched all these people moving around. They were carrying their laptops and, you know, there's a couple of cafes and almost restaurants in this central area, and it's all, you can look up and all of the corridors are glass so that you can see everyone moving. You can see where the kitchen spaces are in the office. It's just, it was like being in a little hive where you watch everybody move around.
Interesting. Yes.
Yeah. And then I popped over to the Medibank building, which is next door to it, which I believe has won awards for its design, which has this wonderful big, even though it's a multi-story building, it has, again, this kind of central open area with a staircase that winds round.
You
can actually walk up this wonderful staircase instead of popping into a lift, pressing the button and, you know, popping back out again. They can actually, there's physical movement incorporated into this design as well as.
Yes, and there's been some research on that, because it is an opportunity for physical exercise. But the other thing that's been established is that it's also an opportunity for social contact. Because you meet people on staircases and then you say, oh, yeah, I've been wanting to talk to you. It doesn't happen in elevators, in lifts.
Yeah, no, we don't talk.
I've put them in offices where they had more than one floor and they wanted to make sure that that information flowed, you know, freely. And they said, well, if they go out to the fire stair or into a lift, they're not going to have the same opportunities to move back and forth. And they've actually taken the space and put a staircase between the floors for that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because people do stop and have conversations on staircases, don't they? You can just pull to the side and pause and have a conversation there, which you can't do. Lifts go, nope, sorry, end of the conversation.
Got to get off. Yes.
Jacqueline, one final question for you, although I could ask many, many more, and that is, what can individuals do to perhaps improve the way they feel about their workspace? Perhaps they've not had one of these enlightened managers who has asked them and involved them in the design process. So are there simple things that we can do to improve how we feel about where we work?
Well, I think it's important, if you're uncomfortable or you feel unduly fatigued at the end of the day, or something sore, you know, your back or your eyes or something, I think it's important to identify that, because it might be something that you're kind of pushing to the back of your mind, but it is tiring you or making you dissatisfied. Because then if you can identify what the sensations are that you're not comfortable with, then you have a possibility of doing something about it or of asking someone to do something about it. You know, so it might be, well, you know, chair is a big one, and chair height relative to work surface and footrests and things like that. There are ways of working with all those elements to ease stress in the shoulders and neck and back. So that, you know, that might be something. Is that where my dissatisfaction is coming from?
Mm-hmm. So a bit of paying attention first.
I think so, because if it's just there without you, like if I was working with you and you said, well, I don't really like this workstation, I would say, so tell me exactly, what does it feel like? And in what way do you not like it? And then maybe it's, well, it's because I'm next to the wall, I hear all the conversations from behind me because the sound reflects back and it distracts me. You know, so now I've identified that. Now I know there are solutions to things like that. I mean, I was just in an office the other day and they were acoustic absorption panels, really, mm-hmm. on wherever they had actually big flat walls, just for that reason. That's not expensive or difficult. You know, or if it's your eyes, you know, well, they're always scratchy at the end of the day, you know, then, well, let's look at the lighting that you have in relation to the tasks that you're doing. So I think most of these things are fairly simple to solve. I mean, if they're not, that's a whole nother thing. But I think a lot of what makes people a bit uncomfortable are small things that can be solved. And it's a question of identifying them and then being able to say, I think this would be the solution, or could you please find a solution?
So paying attention first and thinking about it, trying to hone in on exactly what it is that's making it difficult, which may be easy, may not be easy to do, but obviously worth persisting with.
It can be something, you know, that's much harder to solve. Like, just trying to think if I had a real example, but let's say that you work, well, it could be something like your team is split onto two floors. You know, that could be a frustration.
Yeah.
And you have to, either you're going up and down or they're going up and down or someone hasn't got information or things, you know, that seems to me that that's a bigger scale of problem, but there's no reason why a reasoned argument to the team manager saying, here's where I'm losing my time, here's where I never got the information I needed, and here were the mistakes that happened. You know, it can be put even, I mean, it's a bit of work perhaps to put it as a, you know, cost benefit type of analysis, but at least you could make a kind of little business case. Saying, you know, if I didn't have to waste this time, and if that group was somewhere where I could reach them, or maybe it's a technology solution. Oh, the manager says, okay, I'll give you all the network screen thing, internal internet, so that you can all see each other when you need to. Now, not that that always solves problems, because then you've got noise from talking, da 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 da. But anyway, they are all solvable, I think.
Yes. Yes, even if it takes a little bit of work.
Yes.
You've got me thinking about my work processes now, even though I often work on my own. But yes, it is sometimes about efficiency. Am I spending too much time setting things up? One of the things I've actually done, I'm using it for the first time today, is my little microphone. You can't see it because it's below the screen, but I was having trouble in this co-working space with a bit of reverb in the room.
Yeah.
Recording is not good. So I thought, well, how am I going to solve this problem? And I found someone on the internet who said, oh, you can just set up these little, it's like a acoustic box for your microphone. So it was little storage box that I got from a home supplies place, a bit of acoustic foam, tuck the microphone in there. And it's, I think my producer will tell me, I think it's solved the problem. And then, you know, where do I set up and those sorts of things. So yes, thinking about the efficiency and the comfort, productivity, all of those factors and what's working and what's not.
Yes. I'm a great believer in keeping workers informed about their environment and encouraging them to understand the building that they're working in. You know, where is my air coming from? Where is my temperature controlled? You know, how do these things happen? I just think that the more people know about the environment, the more they're able to what I would call negotiate with it. You know, this, I know I can make this change. That one I know is more difficult, or will, you know, something like that. or like you just did, you know, I'll go and I'll just, it's reverberating. I can't do much about that, but I can get this box and solve the problem that way. And people need to feel that they have that. I call it control, but it's a lot of it is based on having the information, you know, listening to what the facilities managers tell you about the building. If they make arbitrary rules, find out why, because it may be an arbitrary rule, but it may not be, you know, so things like that. And then I also then feel that it creates a much more positive relationship between the people in charge of facilities and the users in the building, because then they're working together to create a comfortable environment for the user. You know, they become partners in that effort. And I think that's really important.
Yes, I guess it's giving them that sense of autonomy, isn't it? That sense that I have some control, even if, and I know I have heard people say that, you know, where they work in their office building might be near to a west-facing window. So in the afternoon, they actually move, you know, whether they take their laptop or what have you, or whether they just change the nature of what they do in a day so that they book meetings in the afternoons or do the things that move them away from that space into a space perhaps that's a little cooler.
Yes, no, exactly. And I think that's a better solution than trying to put on, you know, lots of blinds and blinds that go up and down and automatic blinds and sun responsive blinds. And it's technology that people often resent because they come down at the wrong time and not everybody likes it. But if you can just get up and move, why not?
Just move yourself.
Yes.
Yeah, so having autonomy, having an involvement in the whole process makes, I mean, it does make a huge difference to us, doesn't it, as human beings, to feel like we do have the capacity and we have the permission to solve problems and do things in a way that suits us as individuals.
And we also take some responsibility too, because with that autonomy and control, we are also saying, okay, we'll contribute to making it work. And I think that's important too.
Excellent. Look, there are so many more questions that I could ask you, Jacqueline. We could talk about this for hours, but I really appreciate the time that you've spent with us today and the insights you've given us and plenty of ideas. I think I'm certainly going to go away and be thinking about my workspace and how I move within it and how I communicate information. And I'm guessing that a lot of our listeners will be doing exactly the same.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. It was a pleasure. I enjoy talking about these things. So thank you for the opportunity.
Wonderful. Thank you.
That was environmental and workspace psychologist Dr. Jacqueline Fisher speaking to us from Montreal in Canada about how where we work affects how we feel and behave, which is one of my favourite topics as a workplace psychologist. And I'm wondering, has this conversation got you thinking about your workspace? Is it working for you? What changes could you make that might make you more comfortable, more inspired, or maybe work to your full potential? Plenty to think about. We've put the links to Jacqueline's books, research and consultancy firm in the show notes for this episode at potential.com.au/podcast. You'll also hear her tips for enhancing your workspace in our downloadable tip sheet there too. And while you're visiting the Potential Psychology website, have you given us a rating or review in iTunes? If not, I'd love it if you could. It's a really simple process. There's a link at the bottom of the show notes for each and every one of our episodes. Or if you're on your phone, you can either link through to the show notes from there, or if you're using the Apple Podcasts app, just scroll to the bottom of the page and you'll see some stars and a link to write a review. I do read every review and appreciate them all so very, very much. So next week is big. Next week is our final episode for this season, and it's a special event because we're celebrating the podcast's first birthday. Woohoo! And the International Day of Happiness, which happens to coincide. And I really need your help in order to celebrate this fully. I'd like you to tell me what makes you happy. The theme for International Happiness Day this year is Happier Together. And to really truly embrace this idea, we're compiling messages from listeners and our past expert guests, along with the best bits of previous episodes and a few other bits and pieces from me, to explore the questions: What is happiness and how do we find it? Getting involved is really simple. You don't have to be live on the podcast. You can just leave me an audio message. Pop over to the Potential Psychology website, and on the homepage and the podcast page, you'll see a big button on the left-hand side that says, "Tell me what makes you happy." Click that and you'll go to my voicemail page where you can record your message either via phone, tablet, computer, whatever you've got. It's super easy, and I have to say I have been listening to some of the messages left so far and they are just a delight. They are making me happy just listening in. So it's going to be a fabulous compilation once we've put it all together, and it'll be launched there on our final episode for the season on March the 20th. So that's all happening. You can leave a message at potential.com.au. There's also going to be plenty of prompts and reminders, or there already are, on our social media pages too. So if you can, or you do follow us and you find those, see those posts, just follow the links and record that way. But don't delay, because we're under a tight time frame here. We'll be putting the episode together and into production very soon, and we really want to be able to conclude your message. Then when it gets to March 20, you can listen in to our final episode, hear yourself on air, as well as plenty of others, and discover what it really means to be truly happy. So that's all from me for this week. As always, thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate it. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode and that you'll be back to listen in to celebrate our first birthday next week.